Welcome to another episode of the Wealth Lab Professional Series podcast. This is with myself, Scott Jackson, and my colleague, Mr. Phil Sproul. Phil.
Hey, how are you, mate?
Welcome. Yeah. I wanted to crack into it. Last week, I did a little social media post on gambling and betting. And I really wanted to hammer the point. I think something that I missed on that point was gambling can be quite fun and investing is quite boring. And that is why people do one or the other. And I think we obviously know that should you keep betting, the longer you keep betting, that the chances are that you'll end up with nothing. And the longer you keep investing, the chances are you'll have more than you started with. I think it's an indicative point, but I wanted to also just throw this one out. So let's just say, and again, I'm explicitly recommending you don't gamble. You don't do it. All right. Just don't. However, if it's the Melbourne Cup, if it's whatever event you're looking at, there is a principle that people have used, which referred to the Kelly bet. Now, this is not going to turn into a betting podcast. All this is just I'm highlighting.
Right.
This is the Kelly bet is effectively referred to as an optimal bet strategy. So what it means is just calculating of, let's say, for example, your $50, your $10, your $5, your $100, whatever that is. This is a mathematical strategy that some people can use when it comes to how much of their pot do they bet, or how much money have you got in total do you bet each time? Because it's a fixed percent. If you make more money, you bet more. And if you lose money, you bet less, but you still bet the fixed amount. So it's suggesting a bet size of around about 12% of your pot, something like that.
Right.
So if you've got $100, it's suggesting you bet $12.
Gotcha.
And that is going to have, at this point, an optimal Kelly bet. If you're betting less, you've got a chance of it not working as well, and it's considered a suboptimal bet. If you're betting more, you've got a much higher chance of blowing yourself up. So it's about survivability. So look, I thought I'd throw that one out here. There's been a lot of research into it. Just to follow on last week's episode, Kelly bet is something that people who are in the professional gaming world can use. And if you are so interested in a flutter on the horses or whatever it is, the Kelly bet may be an option for you as well to have a look at. What do you think, Phil?
I have two thoughts on that. The first one is it looks pretty interesting. You know, I love a bit of nerd stuff. My second thought is that looks like a hell of a lot of math for a Sunday afternoon footy game.
Well, look, I mean, so what's interesting is there's a bit of variance here. So these guys were looking 12. I actually think it's closer to 20%, which is kind of, so that's an 8% difference here. But this is giving example of a dice throw. There's a fair bit of math in this, and there's a lot of white papers around how people will. Have you heard of the experiment where they gave people they said, look, here's what's going to happen. You can flip the dice, you can flip this coin 100 times, and it has a 60% chance of turning heads and a 40% chance of it turning tails. And what they found was even though people knew that the odds were skewed in the way of heads, they still would bet in suboptimal terms. And I think they gave it to something like 200 participants. There was still a fairly high number of people that blew up, meaning they bet on the wrong thing and they ended up with nothing.
Yeah, right.
So suboptimal betting is very common. So that is something to have a look at. So this website here, I mean, I've literally just Googled it, is suggesting a 20% stake size. And I just want to clarify again, I'm not recommending this. I'm just saying, should you feel the flutter, the Kelly bet would be a strategy that you could consider. Mm. So that's the first point I wanted to touch on.
I like it.
Nice. Phil, what have you been looking at last week?
Well, look, yeah, I think, Twitter feed and anyone that's even tangentially linked to the financial advice industry has probably been all over the financial advice review. I'm sure you've probably seen the recommendations or at least had a bit of a look. But there's a few interesting bits and pieces in there. If anyone that's not familiar,
tell me about it. So if you know, I know we're at the coal face of it. Why don't you give us a little bit more specific? What does it look like? What's happening?
Well, I think just from a consumer perspective, you know, you think about we've had the Royal Review into and the Royal Commission into banking and financial planning, all that sort of thing, and we saw that all play out. And off the back of it, there was a raft of new legislation that sort of came out. But I think one of the things that's become one of the things that we've noticed out of this is that, and it was probably not intentional, but it's driven the cost of financial advice up.
Yeah.
You know, and it's purely a lot of it's to do with a few factors. One of it's been, you know, we've gone from something like 25,000 financial advisors in Australia to like less than 16,000.
That was 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. So not a lot of industries that are contracting as fast as ours. Maybe right. Like saddle makers or maybe boot makers or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Might be about it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's so I think, you know, there's tons of demand for advice still, but there's less advisors there to give it. And then the obligations on us when we're providing that advice are so stringent that it's, you know, it's led to an increase in cost.
Yeah.
And it's led to a lot of financial advice firms only wanting to focus on the big end of town, you know, chasing the big dollars, the big clients, which I think you and I are both probably pretty passionate about playing in the same space, which is looking after your sort of everyday Australians, and your mums and dads are the ones that really need advice. And, you know, you sort of built the business around being able to be run lean enough to be able to provide that advice at an affordable cost. But it's just interesting to see this review now. They've actually realised probably the error of some of the regulation and looking to start to unwind some of this stuff. But one of the things I found super interesting was they're starting to talk about a different level of advice for product providers, for non-qualified advisors to start giving advice.
So what does that mean? So if I'm a layman person, what does that involve?
Yeah, so it could just be, you know, old mate on the front counter at the bank or at a super fund being able to give some sort of limited financial advice without the same level of...
Well, tell me, is that a bad thing?
Well, I don't know. I'm actually undecided. It's, if we look back, you know, if we look at the past, product providers playing advice probably didn't necessarily end as well as it should have. People without qualifications providing advice probably isn't going to end that well. But I don't know. It's going to depend on how.
Don't we have an aligned benefit here? Because here we are saying, and this is what I've been arguing, saying we at this point in time we're issuing statements of advice. At the moment, we're set up for it, and we're one of the last ones left. There's not a lot of people doing what we're still doing.
Yeah, true.
We have an incentive to keep doing what we have and to try and keep people out or other people out. So it's almost like we're saying. And this is some of the people who've been criticizing this advice. This working paper, this document, the review, have been planners that have got their little field. They want to go through the documents. They want to keep the SOAs because it keeps other people out and it keeps their advice fees high. And I think that also forgets that we should be in the business of helping people and providing advice reasonable terms, and a good advice focus to me makes sense. But I don't think anyone will ever get it right, to be honest.
No, it's a good point. And look, I think, you know, that the proposal, you're right, like it is about getting more advice to more people. And I think that's a great thing, and particularly for those lower balance clients that maybe just need a bit of guidance but aren't ready or, you know, prepared to pay the fee or just don't need to at that stage of their life. It's great to have an option for them. I just want to see some more detail. You know, this whole provision around, they'll only have a requirement to provide good advice. I mean, that's a very loose term and I'd love to see how that's interpreted. We'll just have to wait and see how it sort of plays out. But there's some fascinating things getting thrown around.
What's the option? The other option is like the Barefoot Investor book. That's it?
Yeah,
you know, well, you're going to have, well, you know, at the moment we've got this stratosphere of middle Australia being, and look, again, we haven't, so I think we need to, like, we have an aligned benefit to protect our, whatever that we've, you know, this compliance regime that we've put in place and that we comply with. And we'll see what happens. But hopefully for people seeking advice in the future, they get quality advice at a fair price that matches their needs.
Yeah, I hardly agree. And I think ultimately we'll probably get somewhat closer. I just really want to see. I love these throwaway terms that somehow find their way into legislation, you know, such as good advice. Well, that's cool, but, you know, show up to 20 people, they're all going to have a different opinion.
Correct. And that's why I see it was interesting when you show a scenario to four different or five different providers and they come out with different outcomes for the same advice scenario, which means if you're listening to this, make sure that you engage a proper advisor. That's the summary of it. Wealthlab.com.au, book a meeting. Feel free to do that.
Yeah, 100%. Right.
I'm moving on. I want to keep this podcast going. Yeah, all right. This was published on, this was published yesterday. Help! Exclamation mark. My self-managed super fund is empty after I lost it in crypto. Mm. A reader has asked for advice on risky withdrawals after setting up a DIY fund, which is a self-managed super fund, with $58,000 from the industry fund rollover. Phil, what's your first take on that headline?
Oh, mate, it's just... This is, again, another thing that makes me super torn because, you know, self-managed super fund, you know, if you know what you're doing, sure, invest in what you want to invest in. I know that's the reason a lot of people do these things, but geez, I just see so many people get burnt on so many things. And there's so many crypto schemes out there. I'd like, part of me just says it should be illegal to invest in crypto in the SMSF. The other part of me goes, no, bugger off, regulator. I should be able to do what I want. But man, people need protection. I've seen some wild stuff happen to people. I had a colleague a little while ago had someone ring up that had lost $500,000 in a crypto scam and then had been contacted by an agency that was going to help them get their $500,000 back.
Yeah, they do it again. Yeah, the same thing.
Yep, only 50 grand and we'll get this $500 back.
I just want to say, so this is a mania. So the next mania that's coming up is AI. I reckon we got, do you remember at the height of 2020, there was like random speculative mining businesses that renamed themselves to, you know, XYZ blockchain. And all of a sudden the stock price went up a lot. Just by changing the name, and that I will make a prediction. I'll make a soft prediction that, you know, at some point in 2023 there will be a random biotech business or mining business or whatever that changes their ASX code to like AI.ASX, and it'll pop because people think it's an AI. I reckon the AI investment is the next bubble, and I think we'll see exactly the same types of scenarios coming out. So what this guy is doing is he's written into the Fin Review requesting some advice. Probably should have got it beforehand, but that's sort of, well, to be clear, definitely should have got it beforehand. Not should, probably. clearly didn't, you know, realistically, a self-managed super fund should not be set up with $58,000. It's just the cost of setting up a relatively quite high. Then he's pumping 30 grand in crypto, and then he withdrew the rest as an early access withdrawal, and he's spent the rest. Mm. He's got two kids and a wife, and his wife is pregnant, so there's a third one on the way.
Yeah, it makes my skin crawl just even hearing that read out.
So it looks like this article is just saying, as long as you legitimately were able to pull the funds out under the early exemption, then that's okay. And we haven't, and you've committed any crime for losing money. Unfortunately, this guy has completely cooked his future retirement, I suspect. So I had this article sitting on my desktop. I hadn't shown this to Phil beforehand, so I just wanted to show that whilst we're recording so that I just get you.
I know the other thing that immediately jumped in my brain when I saw that. So even if that turned out well for him, I don't know if you bought crypto, traded crypto, whatever.
I'm not commenting. But I'm not getting into it, but I did see the mania.
It's not relevant to the point, but the point, mate, could you imagine doing the tax? That would just be so difficult. And I can only imagine it would significantly add to the running cost of your fund. And at 58 grand, you're already smoking yourself on fees. But anyway, that's just a separate point.
God, it'd be a mess, wouldn't it? Because you're going to have to ask for documentation and see, make sure the auditor has to review it. And oh my God, how's the auditor going to sign off on it? For those that don't, so when you have a self-managed super fund, it needs to be audited every 12 months. And the actual auditor needs to check statements. And some of these crypto things don't have any statements. You can't get it.
Some obscure European crypto platform does not care about your tax needs.
Log into my MetaMask account and have a look at it. So the summary from that is that just be mindful. I think be mindful of a mania. Crypto clearly was a mania. I reckon AI is the next one. What was the last mania that you were aware of? What comes to mind?
Oh, it's a good question.
I mean, like property, like certain property things. That was a lot of stuff where a lot of money got lost on crypto.
buy now forestry schemes.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Big deal. It was a long time ago. Yeah, buy now pay later was a big one.
Buy now pay later was a big one. People buying shares, and there's interesting. Lastly enough, there's a few buy now. There was a buy now pay later business that went under yesterday. Mm. Whatever it was called, whatever it was, just an Afterpay clone
equivalent. Yep.
Yeah, and then, you know, they listed on the stock market. Their shares were at one point worth over $4 a share. They had, you know, $100 million market cap, and now they're insolvent.
Yeah, it's funny. It's actually funny because just before you'd sent me that article, I'd actually gotten an email. I don't actually remember having ever used them, so I'm not sure why I was on their mailing list.
Oh, wow.
So I've got a mailing an email from the receivers saying that even though you may see this in the news, you're still expected to make your repayments. Well, it's interesting.
Really?
I don't owe you any money, but yeah.
So let's just clarify. So yeah, so the buy now, pay later. So if they go under, then you still have to pay the receiver.
There you go. That's according to the email they sent, yeah.
So the post that I've got in front of me here, Phil, is one that we were talking about, which was another advisor who's based in the States. And he goes, the second people try to negotiate my fees or say it should be cheaper for them because they require less work, he sends them on to someone else. Those types of people, they never are less work. They always be the most work. So just give me your hot take on if someone comes in trying to negotiate your fee. Down. Because I feel like they're not going to be a lot of work.
Yeah, I mean, I think that statement's 100% correct. I mean, I don't know, if I'm seeking financial advice and I've gone to the trouble of researching and finding a good advisor that I trust, the last thing I want him to do is start cutting corners because I don't want to pay the fees. You should want me to dedicate the same amount of work to you as I would to anybody else. You should want me to, even if you come to me with, you know, 100 grand, you should want me to treat you like you got $10 million. So, you know, negotiating on the fee, it doesn't make sense. It costs us money to provide a service, and
we have a service. Yeah, to be clear, we have a base fee, and then we go from there. The base fee is a system that we have developed to move people forwards on their wealth journey towards their retirement goals. And it is not a one-off single type advice. It is a process that we will take you through if you're seeking our advice, and we've got about 7 points specifically that we run through around all aspects of the advice. It takes time. It is a valuable service, and it's why we have a base fee. So look, it hasn't happened recently, but if someone does come in looking to negotiate down the fees, I'm going to refer them to a Twitter post and say, I'm not your guy.
yeah, fair.
We need to disagree with each other more. That'll be something next week. So Phil and Scott disagree on something.
All right. I'll find something polarizing.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week. See you next week.